Today's program was brought to you by Mood Magazine, a new international quarterly publication about music and food. For more information, visit moodmusicfood.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. We have a very special show for you today. I'm extremely, extremely excited. Someone who's been very influential in my own education about wine, the author of the newly released World Atlas of Wine 7th edition. If you have any of the first 6 editions, congratulations to you. It is time to update your collection and get the 7th edition. We have Jancis Robinson on the show, along with writing the World Atlas of Wine with her co-author Hugh Johnson. She's the wine correspondent for the Financial Times. She has the website jancisrobinson.com. I find that always comes up in my Google search. Right, well done on
good.
That.
Good.
And even updating Jancis Robinson right before the show. So, the book Grapes was released.
Wine Grapes
last year, profiling over 1,300 grapes. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Quite a few more from in the 90s when you, which I also still own, the Wines, Grapes, and Vines. Quite a bit of an update. Anyway, Jancis, welcome. Thank you so much.
It's fun to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. When I am doing wine research, I go to you. When I'm researching to for a class I'm about to teach, when I was studying for the WSET diploma, and when for a short time I thought I might want to do the Master of Wine, I would always go to your works, especially now. Where do you go for research? How did you put this together? Because you couldn't look at the 7th edition before it was
No. And I suppose one... that my biggest reference book, you haven't mentioned, I don't think, the Oxford Companion to Wine.
Oh, of course, the Oxford Companion. I've actually purchased multiple copies of that because I've used it so much that they've been tattered to pieces.
Well, of course, none of these works is a solo effort by any means. Obviously, with the World Atlas of Wine, I just started to help you with the 5th edition. I had nothing to do with the first 4. And we have, to put these things together, we have a network of informants around the world, and they pass on what they've observed about their region. And what's quite funny is that how much overlap there is. They always report trends as though they're distinct to their region, but they usually mirror things that are happening everywhere. And the same is true. I've got a wonderful team on everything that I do. I used to be a control freak and say I would never, ever employ anyone. I would always do absolutely everything myself. But in my mature years, I'm learning to delegate, which is very nice.
Well, let's talk about some of these trends. Some that I noticed in, I did not have a chance to read the
not Atlas every word
cover to cover. It is a quite the tome, dense with maps and incredible information. Some of the things that I did notice in my reading was a movement towards more transparency towards the geography and
more expressive wines, less huge blockbusters that really show off winemaking more than vineyard. I think we're all moving more to a reverence for the land, aren't we? And wanting to hope we can get to grips with the character of a vineyard by how it tastes rather than smothering it with oak, say.
Yes. And are you finding that this is even true in newer regions that are sort of finding their way?
Oh, yes. I would say it's a definite trend almost everywhere. But perhaps in the Napa Valley, there are still people who don't believe that who are still looking for the powerhouse in their wines.
Yes, I love you had a line in here that was, we're moving away from wines that are massive just for the sake of being massive.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. And then new regions that you're looking at?
New regions. Well, so the wine world has been expanding so rapidly, and newer regions are now making their presence felt abroad and exporting, that we had to do 25 new maps for this 7th edition of the World Atlas of Wine. And of course, I mean, the spread of where Vineyards is planted has changed too, as climate change opens up whole new regions. I mean, who would have thought that Scandinavia would be having vineyards, you know? But I had quite a decent ice wine from Sweden the other day. And Belgium and Holland, and obviously England, have their own really pretty well-established wine industries now. But then there are places that used not to be wine producers and are getting in on the act. China is an obvious example. You know, it's very recent that China's produced grape wine. And now, according to the official figures, China has the sixth biggest area planted with grapevines in the world already.
Wow. And I was well aware of China producing wine, but surprised to hear you say that China produces great wine.
I don't think I ever said China produces great wine. It does produce drinkable wine now,
okay.
Which is a big advance from when I first went there in 2002, when you were really struggling to find decent wine. I go every 2 or 3 years, and just recently I've noticed the proportion of drinkable to good wines has dramatically increased.
All right.
So we're still not talking great wine. Definitely not.
A great deal of wine.
And yeah,
we're
sure.
working towards in that. Well, that's fantastic. And then two of the regions that right forefront in your introduction, Kakheti in Georgia and the coast of Croatia, two places that I've been to recently. I was surprised to see them right up there.
Yeah, you're lucky. I was meant to get to Georgia. I've never been to Georgia. My wonderful colleague, Julia Harding, has recently, and she was most impressed. And Hugh went ages ago, my co-author of the World Atlas of Wine, and he just loves it. And as I understand it, wine is absolutely an inextricable part of Georgian culture, right? I mean, they don't entertain without millions of toasts and all that. And of course, they make it in such a bizarre, traditional way, don't they? Quite unlike anybody else.
Yeah, the Georgian meal is extraordinary. Yeah. There's a tradition of piling plates on top of another so that you don't see the table. And then one person is dedicated as the toastmaster. And then throughout the meal, they'll stop and give these beautiful, long, heartfelt toasts. And they're just some of the most talented orators in Georgia. It's extraordinary. And the wines are fascinating as well.
And absolutely unique, aren't they? They've got their own interesting indigenous grape varieties, as well as the, you know, making wines in clay pots, which they bury. I mean, who else does that? Although people are starting to copy, aren't they? Just an experiment. And I would say another of the big macro trends that I spotted for, it came hurtling towards me, preparing this 7th edition, was pretty much everywhere is moving away from, is a little bit bored with the big international grape varieties and wanting more diversity. Wanting to rescue indigenous grape varieties and celebrate them, and realizing that will put a region on the map because nobody else for the moment has those varieties. And if they're in a place like Australia, which doesn't have centuries and centuries of viticulture to fall back on and go and explore ancient indigenous varieties, really put in the effort to import cuttings of what they call alternative varieties, just widening the mix, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's in line with the ancient history of wine, where grapes would be kind of decimated all throughout. It's so interesting to think that in our modern history, people have stayed kind of with such a small amount.
Really narrow range, yes. Wasn't it? I think it reached its nadir in about the mid-90s. I made a television series for the BBC around the world called Jancis Robinson's Wine Course, and the last bit was me standing in a Chilean vineyard saying, I have seen the future of wine, and it's called Cabernet and Chardonnay.
I remember this so distinctly, you saying this, and I was going to ask you about it. The first time that I ever watched that was at an NYU class with Linda Lowry in her beverages class, and she played the series for us, and then I purchased it on DVD. That is, to this day, some of the only wine TV that I know of.
It's true. I mean, it's partly, I think, because wine, unfortunately, unlike food and cooking, doesn't naturally lend itself to a television treatment, because the sad truth is nothing much moves in wine. I mean, cameramen get to a winery and make a beeline for the bottling line, which is the most boring thing for most of us. But for a cameraman, it's heaven, because at long last, the something moves a little bit more than the wind blowing a vine, you know, or a barrel being rolled. Also, it cost a heck of a lot. We filmed it, so we you can imagine how many silver boxes we had to unload every time we got to an airport. We went all around the world. And I think no one has sort of bit the bullet to make that investment again.
I want more.
Well, have you got $1 million, preferably $2 million, to invest in series two? I'd be very grateful.
Yes, I will. If I do, I want you to do it. I want more.
You're very kind. Yes. What I ought to do is silly, because I think, in a funny way, I think I've probably made more TV programs about wine than almost anybody, because I did quite a few series before that as well, and I used to do something on the Food Network and various other things. I really ought to do more videos on my website, oughtn't I? It's just a question of the hardware and the time, but I will.
Yes,
I will.
And I mean, it's becoming more accessible as well. We've had the hardware in our group, and we worked with some videos, but then just didn't make the time for it. And you can the equipment is so much smaller now.
It's getting smaller and smaller, isn't it? Yeah.
You should do it.
I must. Yeah. Note to self.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the grape trend, because this is something that, as someone who comes from an Italian wine background, that would be me, that I'm particularly interested in. We really focus on those indigenous grapes.
And
in
you,
Italy.
As an Italian son of Italy, should be very proud, because when we researched wine grapes and decided we'd concentrate only on those grape varieties making wine commercially that we could find, it certainly was the case that Italy had the most.
Yes.
Yes.
I've been saying it, and I'm glad to hear that it's true.
And I would also say that Italy has the most people researching old grape varieties and you know, propagating them and micro-vinifying them and multiplying them. And so I'm quite certain that if we do edition two of wine grapes, we'll probably increase the total number of varieties from, I think, 1,368. Probably it'll be close to 1,500 in a few years' time, I think.
Wow. So when you read of these estimates of Italian grapes being anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 indigenous grapes to Italy, are most of these non-commercial? Are these?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. And some of them, I'm sure, make wine so dull that, you know, it's not just the fact that it's an unknown grape variety that's enough to make an exciting wine. And also, of course, there are some varieties that whose grapes are much more suitable for eating.
Yes.
Or raisining, making dried grapes. Italy definitely has diversity. And, of course, it's got the terrain, you know, back to geography. Italy's got more varied terroirs and climates, I would say, than, say, France or even Spain.
I love hearing you say that, because that is my line often, and so it feels good hearing Jancis say that. So tell us a little bit about how you spend your time, because you have so much going on. It is extraordinary to think, Gabe, who's the chef, and Catherine, our pastry chef, and I are working on our first cookbook, and it takes an extraordinary amount of time. But there is nothing near the kind of information that you see in the World Atlas of Wine in our little cookbook. Between the books and the column and everything that you do, how do you spend your time?
Well, I certainly have lots of help, as I said. I was born on a Saturday, and there's a nursery rhyme in Britain which says, Friday's child is loving and giving, Saturday's child works hard for their living. And I am a bit of a workaholic, I have to admit. And I couldn't do everything that I do now, say, if my children were still young. And I don't see how anyone manages to have a daily updated website and young children. That would be really tricky, I think. I sort of get closer and closer to deadline every single time, and I sort of fall back on the thought, well, I've always managed it in the past, so I suppose I'll manage it this time, but probably one of these days I'll get caught out and miss a deadline.
You still have never missed a deadline?
I sometimes go over by a day when I know it doesn't matter if I've gone over by a day. And In the past, I think publishers used to give me deadlines sort of 3 months ahead of when they really needed it, because most people missed by 3 months. And then they realized I'm a bit obedient, so they give me a more realistic deadline of when it really is due. I don't know. I do have a life, actually. I never work at night. I'm very lucky. I'm married to a restaurant critic, the restaurant critic of the Financial Times. So we have lots of friends, lots of family, love entertaining, love being entertained, love eating out. So occasionally even do something unrelated to food and drink. So I do definitely have a good evening life, but during the day, I do work pretty hard.
I was pleasantly surprised to hear when we had our little pre-show interview. It's a chance. So the interview is going to be at Roberta's. It's a restaurant in... Yeah, I know Roberta's. I've been there. You don't need to tell me that. What are some of your favorite restaurants in New York?
Well, I must say, I think... all of the sort of Danny Meyer group are just up my street. You know, they're comfortable... They have great wine lists and lovely staff and delicious food. So what's not to like?
You know, there.
And that's my style. I think I'm not a great one for ticking off the fanciest, the 3-star, the formal, the multi course, and all that. Actually, our son's just become a restaurateur, so he's got the Quality Chop House in London, and that, of course, is my favourite restaurant at the moment. In New York, what else? The scene changes the whole time. It's impossible to keep up. Yeah. If I said any more, they probably don't exist anymore, because they'd be from a previous visit.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and I want to hear from you how the scene has changed since the last edition of the World Atlas of Wine, just 5 or 6 years ago, and apparently has changed quite a bit. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Jances Robinson on In the Drink.
What's Mood? Mood is a quarterly magazine about music and food. For its creators, not many things can beat a good record and a delicious meal. Maybe a well-written story or a gorgeous photo. Well, that's all in Mood. The magazine looks at music and food in a cohesive and unique way, with a keen eye to design and high-quality writing. Its contributors are located around the globe, and the stories span accordingly. Check it out today at moodmusicfood.com. That's moodmusicfood.com.
You're lazy, but you just might find it's them that's crazy. I'm just raising them rats. I'm making dough and fat, hanging up their hats. No, we ain't living like that. So tell your mama.
We're back on In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, here with Jances Robinson, and holding her beautiful new book, The World Atlas of Wine. We were talking a little bit about some of the macro trends that have happened since her last edition, but something that I'm really interested in is, we were just chatting actually over the break, some of these new countries that you're featuring in the book.
Sure. Well, you mentioned Georgia, and Croatia is really making more of an impact mm-hmm. now, and has some really distinctive wines as well. Turkey gets its own special treatment this time, because that's a really interesting wine producer that's getting more, starting to export more. Again, probably because it's close to the cradle of viticulture where wine was first made. It has, like Georgia, its own range of really interesting indigenous grape varieties, each one making wine distinctly different, and a huge variety of terrains. You know, you've got the sort of European bit, and then you've got the Mediterranean coast, and then this amazing Cappadocia and freezing cold in winter kind of thing. We've introduced a map of, we've extended the Douro. We've got northwest Spain in detail, you know, Galicia and just over the border in Bierzo, which is making so many great wines, I think, things like Valdeoras and Ribera Sacra and things like that. Totally unlike everyone's stereotype of Spain being hot and dry. It's actually rather green and wet.
The amount of wines that we've been seeing just since we opened up our wine bar Anfora back in 2010 from that particular area, it's just a huge increase, a flood of those wines.
Sure. We've, for instance, in sort of outside Europe, we've added Mornington Peninsula in Australia that makes nice copies of Burgundy, really. We've added Baja California in Mexico, which now has a bit of a wine culture. We've added a whole two pages on Virginia, believe it or not. And one that perhaps you will be interested in, Etna, which, you know, there's some lovely wines coming from those old sort of terraces on ancient lava on the cone that is the volcano of Etna. And just the shape of the vineyards, the vineyard area there, really makes the point of how important exposition is. It just goes around in one little sector, you know, where you get sufficient sunshine to ripen the grapes and everything's in the right
And certainly you think that in that northern hemisphere, you want to be on, you think, oh, we should probably be on the south side of Etna to get the sun. But it's really the northeastern side that has those best vineyards.
Yeah. But you don't want to get it too hot, do you? Yeah.
Oh, that's right, because we're down in Sicily.
Yeah.
I think that some of the most interesting places for wine emerging in the last few years have been on these volcanic soils. Between Santorini, the
Yes, I love Asiatico and I agree.
So we actually have a question from @DemiLove. This is a question for Jan. Says, do you think that the next generation of wine drinkers will find and nurture their own classic varieties, or will they drink more as their parents did?
And I assume that question refers to grape varieties, don't you think?
I would think
Yeah. Well, I think you can already see that there are certain grape varieties that are sort of hot among what you might call the New York Somme clique, such as you and your pals. You know, Trousseau, for instance, seems to be a bit trendy, and Poulsard, and that's more perhaps of a Jura, a regional thing, than a grape variety thing. I would be surprised if grape varieties ended up being segmented in terms of generation, quite honestly. I think it's a question of just getting them in the market, sharing them with everybody, and most people will like them. I don't see why a son would like a Trousseau, but the father wouldn't. But, of course, as far as creating trends goes, it does tend to be done by the younger generation.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to agree with you on that. Mm. And let's see. Okay. And Jancis, I'm just so baffled. It's the first time we've had a question in a long time. I don't know if I'm supposed to answer and give my opinion as well, but it's definitely, that's definitely a question for Jancis. But thank you. And please, keep the questions coming. We love them. It's a fun way, for us to interact with you guys. What is in store for you next? Do you have any other books coming out? Is it a maintenance of the website and Financial Times?
It's daily maintenance of jancisrobinson.com, or weekly feeding of Financial Times. I write a bi-monthly column that I syndicate a bit. Books, I've started updating the Oxford Companion for its fourth edition. So perhaps we can meet again in 2 years' time when that comes out.
I would love that. You know, and when I was back into more serious studying about wine, I always found that I had a hard time understanding maps. I liked looking at them, mm-hmm. but when it came to really understanding them, I had a hard time. But your maps are beautiful in here.
And I'll tell you something, they look even more beautiful on the iPad version of mm-hmm. the World Atlas of Wine, because there you can zoom in, you know? You can zoom in and see every detail of the maps and the labels. And the pictures just really look stunning.
And how do you find the iPad version? Do you just
type I don't have an iPad. At least I do, but I'm ashamed to say I don't really use it. And I'm sure, but I have been shown it, and I've been hugely impressed. Hugh is a big iPad user, my co-author.
Extraordinary. Mm. Well, I wish that was around, and I think that the people who are studying for exams or just have an interest in cartography in general would be interested in that, absolutely.
Much lighter, too.
Yeah, and much lighter. I carried this book from Park Slope to Bushwick this morning, and a little cumbersome to read on the subway, but I know it well, and I really love it. What are you drinking at home? What do you have?
Everything.
A cellar?
Yes, got a couple of little cellars. But I taste so much for my work. You know, the house is always full of mm-hmm. bottles with, you know, one sip taken out of them, and about one in 30 is really exciting enough to drink. All sorts of things. I'm never in a rut. I love the new. I'm always looking for. Any new producers, new places, new grapes. Love it.
And what are some of the most surprising things that you've learned while researching this book?
That's a tricky one. Well, it wasn't perhaps so much researching this book as the last one, which is American Wine, in which most of the work was done by Linda Murphy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, who would have thought that every single state of the Union would have a winery? That in the 90s, that seemed pretty unlikely. Of course, what's great about this country is that it's gone from being judgmental about wine and thinking it was evil to absolutely embracing it and loving it. And perhaps the biggest surprise is how Asia has embraced wine. Because mm-hmm. when I started writing about wine in the 1970s, I was told there's something about the Asian palate, and Asians will never be wine drinkers. How wrong that was.
Yes. And I mean, certainly, how great does wine go with so many of the various Asian cuisines?
Yes, absolutely.
How could you deny that?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what tips would you have for someone who's interested in learning more about wine? How do you
progress?
How do you take information, internalize it, and continue to build on that?
Well, you know what? I'm often asked that, and I should say, buy my books, visit my website. But actually, what I always say is, if you like wine but want to know a bit more, unless you enroll on a course, which is a good thing to do, mm-hmm. establish a relationship with a good local retailer, the same way you would with a local bookseller. And it's very, very similar, strong parallels. Tell them what you've liked so far, and it's in their interests to introduce you to something a bit more interesting or something more better value, or just lead you along the way a bit. If you don't like what the first retailer you choose suggests, then find somebody else, you know. But I think that is a mutually beneficial relationship that can work really well.
Now, I get the feeling that many of our listeners are in the industry and have some experience. If you want to take it from some experience to really, really knowing your stuff,
then ascend the mountain that is the Master of Wine exam, I suppose, which is the Everest of wine education.
It is certainly very challenging. I did that the first 1 year and was recommended to go on to the second. And I said, I had enough. That was enough.
I think my friends and family might like to see me occasionally. Yes.
Yes. How much time does that actually take? Do you have a feeling that might be even more time intensive than going the Master Sommelier route?
Or? I don't know quite enough about the MS qualification, although several of my friends either are MSs or have tried. But one friend comes to stay regularly with us when she has taken her MS exams. The trouble is, even with the Master of Wine, I'm not up to speed. I did it in 1984. I was the first non-trade person to to get the Master of Wine qualification. And it's changed out of all recognition since then, not because they want to make it more difficult, just because the world of wine has become so much more complex. So I think I did it in a year, but then it was simpler. And nowadays they say you have to reckon on a minimum of 3 years, really.
At least, if you're really good.
Yeah.
Wow.
And one guy managed to pass, I think, in his 12th or 13th year of study. Can you imagine?
That is dedication.
He's dedicated.
That is dedication and passion. Mm. One last little thing that you know I've always wondered about, and you've mentioned a little bit in your intro, is some of the wine labels that you picture in the World Atlas,
which was an innovation of Hughes when he first produced the first edition in 1971. No one had reproduced labels in a book before, and now I suggested that the labels should represent wines that we really like and really approve of, and or are absolute sort of pinnacles of respectability and, you know, the biggies or whatever. But, of course, there's nearly enough room for all the labels that we want. So sometimes we'll drop a label from one edition because it's been in the last two. And so no one should feel upset if their label isn't there.
No one should. Rather, if you see a label that you don't know, I like to look for it and go out and try to to search for it. Jan says, I can't thank you enough.
Great pleasure.
I'm a little starstruck. I can't believe that you are here in front of me, someone who as long as I have been reading about wine, I've known about you, and your work has been greatly influential to me. So thank you so, so much. Thank you for putting the World Atlas of Wine 7th edition out into the world. All of this fantastic information, beautiful photos, beautiful maps. I think it's going to increase everyone's knowledge about wine.
You're very kind. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
And before we get going, I do want to mention that this upcoming Sunday, we have our annual charity event that the Epicurean Group organizes called Not My Day Job. It's this Sunday from 1 to 5 p.m. You can get your tickets at notmydayjob.eventbrite.com. I will be there along with 28 restaurants. Wow, incredible. And lots of great wines and beer from Captain Lawrence, Green Hook Ginsmiths, lots of great stuff. So hope to see you there. It'll be a day of fun and musical performances, and hope to see you Sunday. All right, that's been it. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org, and we'll talk to you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.